All right, so I'm here today to chat with you about Entity Framework 7. My name is Rowan Miller. I work as the program manager on the Entity Framework team. I have three quick slides to start with, and then I'm going to drop out to Visual Studio, and we'll spend our time just looking at some of the new features in EF7. So most people probably know this, but EF7 was kind of a reboot from scratch. We didn't copy over the code base from EF6. We started again to achieve a whole bunch of the goals we were after. I'm not going to go through this slide, but this is just kind of a list of everything that works in our current code base and will be there in the initial release. Obviously, a lot of this is just basic ORM stuff that worked in past versions of EF. I just wanted to call out a couple of things that are new features. So shadow properties under modeling is the idea of having a property in your model that's not present in your CLR class. So you can add extra metadata to your entities that aren't actually properties with getters and setters in your CLR class. We have support for alternate keys, which is using something other than the primary key to map relationships to. So I can have a person which has a person ID, and I can also have a social security number, which is another unique identifier for them. In save changes, we now have the ability to batch commands, so we don't do a round trip to the database for everything that you modify. In our query pipeline, we now support partial client eval on link queries. So not everything has to run in the database. You can write stuff in your link queries that's only possible to evaluate in memory. In raw SQL commands, if you start writing a query in SQL, you can then swap over and compose on that using link. And then obviously in our platforms, we have ASP.NET 5 running on core CLR. We have Universal Windows Platform. And then also Mac and Linux running on both Mono and core CLR as options. And kind of in the mix there, we have things like Xamarin Forms, which aren't 100% working yet, but we will have working in the near future. So I just wanted to take that slide to set the stage for kind of what's up and running in EF7 at the moment. I just wanted to run through a few things that are not going to be in the initial stable release. This isn't everything that's not going to be there, because obviously we have a huge backlog of all the features we want to implement. But these are the features that we on the product team feel like are really important things for an ORM that aren't going to be there in the initial release. And so the slide after this is going to kind of talk about when you would use EF7 and when you wouldn't use EF7. So before I start putting things on the screen and you start getting really angry at me, I just want to say, like, we know these are very important things. We're going to have these in the product before we recommend everybody uses EF7 by default instead of EF6. So bearing that in mind, some of the things that won't be there. Initially, mapping insert, update, and delete commands to store procedures. The ability to do lazy loading. Complex and value types. So this is where I have a person who has an address, and I can take the properties that make up address and put them kind of on a separate class and just have an address property on my person. And then if I'm creating a model from a database, I can do that in EF7, but what I can't do is then incrementally push changes to the database to that model. So I do have the ability to regenerate the whole model, but obviously if I've made changes to that model, I don't have the ability to do incremental updates. We have some ability to write bulk configuration over your classes when you're using our Model Builder API, but we don't have like a 100% first class API for doing custom conventions at this stage. And then finally, one of the big things we talked about in EF7 is supporting relational and non-relational databases. So we've done some proof of concept work around non-relational data stores, but none of those will be shipping as part of our initial RTM. Now, the other thing I should mention, I have 45 minutes worth of content, but I'm also happy to make this session as interactive as you want. So if folks have a question about this, this is, I should say, by no means a 100% exhaustive list, but these are kind of the big important things that we think aren't going to be there initially. So. If you have questions while I'm talking, just raise your hand. I'll pause at the appropriate point.
Rowan, when you say it won't be in the first release, how long are you thinking that they might be
Okay, so the question is, if these aren't going to be in the first release, what does that mean? When will they be there? So what I should say, we have RC1 coming out soon. This stuff is definitely not going to be there in RC1. We are going to do some work before we reach RTM. We're not 100% sure what we're going to be able to squeeze in yet. We may start looking at some of this stuff. We may not. But these are the first things that will be on our backlog once we ship RTM or RC1. Like, we're going to start working on this stuff. Actually, the other one that's not listed here, TPT and TPC inheritance mapping patterns, is another big one that would probably cause some people to stick with EF6 before EF7 catches up. Anything else? All right, so that just brings us to a quick bit of guidance. So when would you use EF7? If you're starting on a new application and the things that I've listed that are currently missing from EF7 are okay for you, then you'll be fine using EF7. I have a Go Live license as part of RC1 and you'll be fine to use it. The other place you'd want to use it is if you're writing an app that doesn't target the full .NET framework, so you're writing ASP.NET 5 and you're targeting Core CLR, or you're writing a universal Windows platform app, EF6 won't work in those places. It requires the full .NET framework, so really EF7 is your only choice there. One thing I want to make really clear, we are not at this stage saying that everybody should take their EF6 work and port it to EF7. At some point in the future, we will probably say that EF7 is the recommended release for new applications, but we are going to continue supporting EF6. And to be clear what that means, we're not going to go and add a whole bunch of big features to EF6, but we are doing bug fixes, we are doing minor improvements, and we will continue to take pull requests and contributions to the EF6 code base. Shortly after we RTM EF7, we'll have the EF6.2 release coming out. So you'll start to see bug fixes and pull requests coming in there. Question?
What are some of the other providers besides SQL Server?
So the question was for other providers. So currently we have SQL Server, SQLite, Postgres, and SQL Compact providers are shipped with our releases at the moment, and they will continue. We're also working with some other providers who have asked us not to talk about their plans publicly. You can probably guess what they are if you think about large corporations that might not want their plans discussed publicly. So I think Microsoft a few years back, you can probably guess at those. So we are working with a bunch of other providers too. I should say for Windows, obviously Microsoft SQL Server is our primary target there. When we talk about universal Windows platform and local data, then SQLite is our primary database there. And then when we talk about cross-platform with Mac and Linux, there would be Postgres and another popular open source database that we would also consider to be a primary target there as well. Cool. Any other questions? All right. That's it for slides. Let's drop out. I want to just start running through some of the things that are new and some of the things that are changing in EF7. And the best way to do that would be in Visual Studio. My mouse is having issues. All right, so the first thing I wanted to do is look at how things have changed when it first comes to creating your context in EF7. So in EF6, we had a whole bunch of magic around finding the connection string and creating the database for you and all that stuff. And while that worked great for demos on stage and pressing F5, it really didn't work very well in real applications. It was easy to accidentally get the wrong database or have no idea where your database was. So in EF7, we've simplified all that down a bit. So let's take a kind of 101 look at what a context looks like. I'm going to start with a traditional full .NET application. So this is the kind of pattern you would follow in a console app or a WPF or a WinForms app or previous versions of ASP.NET, where we're not using dependency injection, we're not doing those kind of things. So same as EF6, I have my domain model, which is just represented by CLR classes. I have a context here, which inherits from DBContext. It has a DB set for each type in my model. I have the onModel creating method here, which has the same Fluent API with the same method names that you're used to from EF6. There are some additional APIs to support the new features like alternate keys. And then we have this new onConfiguring method. So this is where I'm very explicit about what database I'm connecting to. So you can see I've got a line of code here, which is just pulling a connection string out of Configuration Manager, which just means it's in my app config file. And the type I have here is a DB context options builder, and you're going to see that type quite a bit. So I can call the use SQL Server method on here and pass in the connection string. There's also an overload of this which takes an existing DB connection. If I have an existing connection from somewhere else, I can just pass that in. Now, a couple of important things to note here. There's obviously no magic going on behind the scenes here. We're not magically picking SQL Server as the default. We're not magically creating a database for you on LocalDB. You're telling us exactly where you want the database. The other thing too, the use SQL Server method is an extension method which comes in because I have the SQL Server provider installed. So because EF supports a wide range of providers, even some of them non-relational, a lot of the methods we call to set up, you know, mappings to tables or cascade delete behavior or passing in DB connections to methods, that stuff all becomes extension methods over our core types. All right, and then when it comes time to actually use a context, this code just looks very similar to what we had in EF6. There's kind of two ways to create a database. So I'm obviously in the mode where I've created my model and I want to create a database from it. We also have reverse engineering where you point tools at a database and get a model created for you. So we still support both of those workflows. If I want a database created for me, I can use migrations, which is great if I want to kind of incrementally have well-controlled changes that can be pushed into staging and production. But if I'm just parting away on my local machine, I don't really want to create migrations all the time. So we just have helper methods to drop a database when it needs to be dropped and create it when it needs to be created. Now, just one thing to point out here that has changed from EF6. In EF6, we had all this complicated logic, so you could use these methods and then you could kind of grow up to migrations. And if you happen to have migrations enabled, then Ensure Creator will use those migrations. In EF7, we did away with all of that and we said there's two paths. There's migrations, and if you want to apply migrations, there's a separate method for that. There's a migrate method. And that will apply your migrations. And if you don't care about migrations and you just want a quick, dirty database, then call Ensure Creator. This is good for unit testing, prototyping, or not unit testing, functional testing, prototyping, things like that. All right, so there's one other change I just want to call out. It's completely unrelated to configuration, but while I have this code here to go and add a blog to our context, in EF6, if you added any object to the context, we would traverse all of its relationships and find everything it was related to and also mark that as added. In a similar vein, if you said this is a modified blog, we would go and find everything else and assume that it was existing posts and existing tags and all that stuff. In EF7, we originally tried having it so that add just operated on the instance that you passed into it, but then that confused people as well. So what we ended up doing, add has a second parameter to it which you can pass in, which is a graph behavior. Which you can see we have two options at the moment, but the possibility for more in the future. We have include dependence, which means add this blog and add any of its children. So if it has posts, they'll also be counted as added. And then we have the single object behavior, which says just add this blog, ignore everything else you can reach from it. I'll tell you to add it if I want it added. So that's just a little bit of a sidetrack into an improvement in EF7. All right, so this is great for simple applications, but what if I'm doing something a little bit more complicated, like a multi-tenant application where I don't always want my context to have the same model and it's not always going to connect to the same database? I should mention while we're here that this pattern will take care of all the caching at the app domain level for you. So it's not going to call on model creating every time. It's going to call on model creating once per app domain per provider. So this pattern kind of takes care of a lot of caching for you. If I want to opt out of that and just kind of control everything myself, then there's a few steps I want to go through. The first thing I want to do is build a model. And so I use the same model builder API that we saw when we overrode on model creating. So I get exactly the same API there. You'll see here I'm creating a set of conventions and passing it in just to make sure I get all the same behavior with primary key detection, everything I would have got from my context. And I then just go ahead and I do all of my configuration here that I would have done. Obviously, because we don't have DB sets on our context, we're not scanning those and finding the types. So I happen to have also just mentioned that post is part of my model here. Once I finish with that, I can access the model property and it gives me back a mutable model. All right, so now we go through and build the options. So DB context options builder is the same type that I got in onConfiguring. So I'm still working with the same types for creating my model and my options. I'm just using them outside of a context. So on that options builder, I'm going to use the same use SQL server method and pass in my connection string. And then I'm also just going to say use model. And I'll pass in the model we created. And this tells the context, don't bother running on model creating or anything like that. I'm just giving you the model. Use this model. And so then if we look at our context, I've set it up so that it takes DB context options in its constructor and just passes it off to the base constructor. So from this point, I can just start creating instances of my blogging context using the options that I created. All right, so these are two patterns for configuring, but obviously in the context of ASP.NET 5, I don't really want either of these because ASP.NET 5 has this whole idea of a startup and dependency injection, all of that baked in. So I've got an ASP.NET 5 app here. You see, we've got the same model here. We have blogs, we have a blogging context. We've done the configuration for the model here, but we haven't done anything about telling it what database to connect to. Because in ASP.NET 5, I would expect to do all that stuff in startup. So let's go over to startup. We'll see we've got some helper methods here you can make use of in configure services. So obviously I want my context to end up in DI so that my controllers and everything can take it into their constructors. So in this case, I've turned on individual local accounts. So I have the ASP.NET identity context already set up in DI. I'm going to go ahead and add my context as well. So I'm going to add a DB context for blogging context. And then I get to write this little action over the top of options. And this is the same DB context options builder that I got in both the other scenarios we already looked at. So use the same use SQL Server method. And now my context is in DI, and it's set up to connect to my SQL Server instance using everything that we set up in startup CS. So the point I wanted you to take away from all this is that EF kind of has some built-in patterns that work well in very simple applications. If you want to take more control, you can kind of step outside of our conventions and you can start building those things yourself. And then if you're working in an environment that already has a pattern like DI, where you set up all that stuff somewhere else, then EF integrates well with those as well. All right, any questions on config before I move on? Nope, all right. So let's look at some more new features. So when I'm working with EF, I write link queries to get data from the database. Now, obviously with a link query, there's a limited set of things that I can express. And sometimes I'm not going to be able to get the exact query I want. It may be that the translation algorithm we run through just generates something that's not as efficient. Or it could be I want to use a database feature that's not immediately accessible from link. So one example of that would be doing full text search on a database. So I have an existing database here. It has blogs and posts in it. And then I've also created a table valued function called findBlogs, which takes in a single search term parameter. And it's going to use whatever makes the most sense for the database engine I'm using, on SQL Server, probably full text search, to go through and find all blogs that contain that search term. So if we swap over, I've got all of my demos are going to use essentially the same model. And I'm just using a console app to kind of boil it down so we get everything else out of the way. So here's our app. We're going to get a search term from the console. We then need to write a query to load it from the database. So using our context, we'll go to the blogs. Normally, we would do things like writing a where clause here. But instead, we want to say, just use some raw SQL to get this. And we're going to get that from our TVF, which was called dbo.findblogs. That takes a single parameter. Obviously, I want parameterization, so I'm not just going to do string concatenation. I'm going to pass in the search term here. EF will take care of wrapping that up into a SQL parameter for me. And then let's just go ahead and run this app. And while that's loading up, I'll just show you I've got a profiler running here. All right, so we're going to search for .NET. It'll find two blogs that contain that. And if we go look at profiler, we'll see that it's executing exactly the SQL that we told it to execute. Now, one thing to call out here, this is slightly different than EF6, where if I dropped out a SQL, I lost all of my mappings that I'd set up. So if the column was called blog underscore ID in the database and it's called blog ID in my class, then dropping out to raw SQL would have expected it to be called blog ID. But in EF7, we run everything through the same mapping pipeline we use elsewhere. Now, the other nice advantage of that, in EF6, if I wanted to do something like ordering these by name, then I would have had to go and start hand editing my SQL to say order by name. In EF7, I can now just start composing on top of this using link. So we'll say order by name. We'll run it again. Finds it all. And then if we go look at what got sent to the database, we'll see we still have my original SQL sent in here, but it's wrapped it so that it can apply the order by for me. So if the SQL I write is composable, then I can continue composing on top of that using link, which is quite nice. Yeah, question. So the question is, how do you know if a link statement executes on the server or the client? So by default, we'll let it execute in either place, but if we ever do client evaluation, we'll write a warning out to the log. And you actually get the option to set that. You can say when there's client eval, either just run client eval, that's fine. The default setting is to say write a warning to the log when you do client eval. And then the other option, if client eval scares you, is you can swap it and say throw an exception if I ever do client eval. So you have the option of blocking it, you have the option of being warned that it's happening, or you have the option of just saying client eval is always allowed. Obviously, in this case, though, this particular query is evaluating everything in the database. All right, any questions? Cool. I'll continue on. All right, next demo, alternate keys. So I'm introducing a new class into our model here. We've got a trackback. So a trackback is when somebody mentions one of our posts in some other online article. Obviously, I capture the URL of the person who mentioned the post. I catch a little abstract to say this was the context in which our post was mentioned. And then I also have the URL of our post that was mentioned. Now, what I could do is use this URL to look up the post ID in our system, but that's just kind of wasted round trips with the database because a URL is a unique identifier for a post. So it'd be better if I could just use the post URL as the foreign key to the post. So let's take a look at what that looks like. So I've got some config here in onModel creating, and I've said pull up the entity for trackback, which is our new type. I've said has one. Now this is a little bit of a change from the EF6 relationship API, where we had has required, has optional. Those APIs were super difficult to use because there was about six things going on at once. So in EF7, we've kind of broken it out. The first things you identify is just whether it's a collection or a reference. So it's has one or has many. And then you do the same for the other side, either with one or with many. So a trackback has one post. A post has many trackbacks. I set up the foreign key to be that post URL. Now, by default, EF will try and map that to the primary key of post. But then I can say it has a principal key and point it to a different property on the principal. Now EF is going to kind of infer from that that post URL needs to be a unique identifier. You can, of course, add your own unique identifiers. You have the ability, if we wanted to kind of over-configure this and say, model builder, pull up the entity for post. Oops. And we can say has alternate key post URL. So I can set up things as unique identifiers without using them in a relationship. But if they're configured in a relationship, then EF just assumes it works by default. Then I've got some code up the top that actually makes use of this. So we're going to grab the first post from the database. We're going to create a new instance of a trackback. Notice that I'm not setting the post URL. I'm just setting the post that it belongs to. And then finally, we'll query back for trackbacks, asking to include all of the posts. Oops. Need to change our startup project. All right, and if we go and look at the SQL log here, we'll see that even though we just set the post reference, it's working out the right post URL here and inserting that as the foreign key. And of course, too, when we query for it, it's doing a join in the database based on the foreign key and primary key that, or the alternate key that we set up. All right, so that is one of the biggest feature asks we got on EF6. So that's now supported in EF7. Any questions on that one before I move on? Yeah, Eric. Yeah, so the question was, is that mapped as a foreign key relationship in the database? The answer is yes, if I just go load up the database. This is what EF creates for me. So post, we have an index here. So we have a unique index on URL. And then if we go and look at trackback, so a unique index on URL on post, and we have a foreign key relationship set up here on the URL on their trackback. All right, any other questions? Nope, all right. Next demo I want to look at is batching. All right, so I have a little bit of code here to set up the database, so I blow it away in case I've already run it, has some data in it, and I create it. Then I'm going to go and make sure we have four instances of blog in our database. So I just wanted to show you that code because I don't like having special code running that people can't see. But that basically gives us a database which exists with four blogs in it. And then the actual thing I'm going to show to demo this feature is we'll get those existing blogs from the database. We're going to mark two of them as deleted. We're going to modify two of them. And then we're going to go ahead and add an additional four blogs. And I'll just go run this. It'll take a second to boot up because I have that logic there. It helps if I set it as a startup project. So it'll just take a few seconds to run because it'll delete the database and recreate it for me. All right, so in EF6, this would have done 8 separate round trips to the database, 4 with insert commands, 2 with update, and 2 with delete. But if we look at the log now in EF7, we'll see that it's now doing everything in a single round trip. In some cases, for delete and update commands, it just appends the SQL. So you can see here we've got delete, and then here's an update. Because there's not a lot we can really do to super batch those up. But then when it comes time to insert, you can see here that we've kind of pulled it all together in a nice single insert command where we insert into the table and then we just have 4 rows saying what values to insert. So this obviously, you can clap, come on. That was lame, all right. This obviously has significant performance benefits, especially when you're working with something where there's some latency between you and the server. You can imagine going from 8 round trips down to 1 makes a big difference. Now, by default, our SQL Server provider and our relational providers make intelligent decisions about what to do. There's obviously a maximum amount of SQL you can stick together. There's a maximum number of parameters you can have. And our provider will take care of that for you. But one knob we do give you, if you want to control it, is you can change the batch size. So in our onConfiguring method here, I've said use SQL Server. And then after use SQL Server, I can start to chain together a bunch of SQL Server specific commands like command timeouts. There's the disable query client evaluation that we were talking about earlier. One of the things I get to set on here is the maximum batch size. So let's just set that to 4 for a second. And I'll just rerun it. Remember, it's going to blow away our database and recreate it clean for us. And then if I go look at the log, I'll see this time I had 2 round trips sent. The first round trip has the delete and update commands because there were 4 of them total. And then the second round trip we did has those 4 inserts all lumped together in one big statement. So you have a little bit of control over how big those batches get. For the most part, though, you can probably just trust what our provider does. All right, any questions on that? Yeah, down the way.
How do you handle concurrency? You said that, for example, can say your batch updates, like you have some concurrency issues, is that handled?
Oh, the question was, so I think this probably answers your question, but we do everything in a transaction. So everything will either succeed or fail. Yep. And we do, obviously, if you've set up concurrency tokens or whatever, we check those for each row. And then if there's a violation in there at all, then we will throw a concurrency exception. The whole transaction will roll back. So. All right, let's keep plugging away. Next one, shadow state. So remember I mentioned before, shadow state is the ability to have properties in your model that are not on your class. So say I want to track a last updated date for each blog, but I don't want to go and add a last updated property to my actual entity instance because maybe I don't control that thing and I can't change it, or maybe I just don't want it in there because it shouldn't really be used in the application. So I'm going to pull up the configuration for blog. And then I'm going to call property where I would normally pass in a strongly typed lambda, but now I can use another overload of that. It says there's a date time property called last updated. And this property just becomes part of my model. I could configure its column name or anything the same as any other property on here. Now to actually make use of that, I've written some code here in save changes that basically gets any instances of blogs that are modified or added, and I'm going to go set last updated on that. So I have the change tracking information. I can get a hold of the property there, last updated, and set its current value to datetime.now. Okay, and then anytime I save a blog, it'll have its last updated set in shadow state and then be saved to the database, same as any other property. Now the other thing that's interesting is being able to query with these things. So let's do db.blogs. And I want to be able to order by the last modified. Obviously, I can't write anything here because it's not actually part of my CLR class. So I use this kind of static EF property method. So it's going to be a property of date time. I access this off the blog, and it's called last updated. And then let's just call it toList on that, or toArray will work, just to pull the actual data into memory. So let's go run this. Remember, our program's going to insert a blog and then read the blogs ordered by last updated back from the database. So if I look at what was written out in the wrong startup project. At least I'm consistent in the problems. All right, so we'll wait for that to finish. We'll go look at Profiler. You can see here we're inserting into last updated, the same as all the other columns in the database. And then when it comes time to select, you see last updated is getting selected back, same as any other property. The only thing that really changes is how that property is tracked. So the information about that property is stored in the state manager or change tracker, and it's not actually part of the entity instance. The other thing I'll just point out while we're here, if you've ever profiled queries on EF6, you would realize that you would never see a query like that coming out of EF6. So in EF7, we've made a real attempt to keep queries what you would actually write by hand. So you should see things be a lot nicer. All right, any questions about Shadow State? Nope. Quiet crowd. I've got one more demo then I will show you. All right, this one is about loading related data. So related data just means I have, I'll just delete all that, we'll type it by hand. All right, related data just means I have, you know, blogs that have posts. So posts are related to blogs. So in the past, you would be familiar, probably if you've used it, with the include method. So I can say bring back all blogs and include their posts. Now what I would have had to do from here if I wanted to include something else from posts, because posts is a collection, I can't just dot through it because it's a collection. So then I would have had to write some really obscure syntax that said posts, post.trackbacks. And that's not really clear what that code does at all. So in EF7, we've introduced a new API which says include posts, and then based on that, then include. What am I doing wrong here? I think my IntelliSense might have got a little out of whack there. And then I'll call toList on it. So that's a lot easier. So then include keeps drilling down through the hierarchy. If I had something else from posts, like maybe contributors, or sorry, from blogs, like contributors, I can drop back out and do an include here, and I can write something else to start re-including from the root level. So I can kind of drill down, and then I can start back at the top and drill down again. All right, so the other thing I wanted to show you just quickly in terms of SQL improvements, I'm going to actually use a different root type. So I'm going to say posts. So we'll include the blog, and we'll also include the trackbacks. And then let's just get a little bit better here, and let's say where. All right, let's just run it like that. I'm going a little off script here, so hopefully that works. Oh. All right, so historically in EF6, this whole query would have got bundled together into a single query against a database, which obviously would have had a lot of joins, a lot of kind of duplicated data coming back on each row. In EF7, we're a little smarter, so we're actually going to split this up into two separate queries. Oh, did I do something wrong here? All right, let's just get rid of this. I'll run it like this. All right, this looks better. So we run one query to bring back the posts and blogs, because we know that for each post there's only one blog. But when it comes to including the trackbacks for each post, for those, we know that there might be multiple trackbacks per post. So if we join them together, we'd actually be bringing back duplicate data for each row in post for every trackback we had. So in this case, we actually split it up into two separate queries. So we see here is the first query, which is bringing back the posts and the blogs. And then here is the second query, which is bringing back just the trackbacks. Now, there are some optimizations we could do here. We actually, probably in this case, don't need to do the join because we know it's a required relationship. At the moment, we do the join because if you do any filters or anything on the core table, we want to bring back trackbacks which only match that filter. So that's why I was doing the where on the title, but obviously did something wrong. But so we're just a lot smarter about how we do SQL generation now. All right. That's just kind of a demo of some of the new features coming in EF7. I'll take a couple of questions if you have them. And then, yeah, over here.
Is there a migration story right now?
Oh, question, migration story from EF6 to EF7. Oh, schema migration, yeah. The same migrations feature that we had in EF6 is more or less experience-wise ported to EF7. We didn't actually do a code port in most cases, so it is new and the APIs are a little different, but the same experience we had on EF6 is actually present in EF7. The one thing we did fix, in EF6, if you tried to use migrations in a development team, you get it in a really weird state. We actually fixed that in EF7, so we keep a centralized snapshot of the model and you will merge that with source control. All right, I can take one more question here.
Do you have any improvements about context loading at the first time?
Oh, question was about context loading. Do we have any improvements? Yeah, the perf is quicker. When we compare EF6 to EF7, obviously depends what model you have and all that stuff, but we're seeing anywhere up to like 60% faster on EF7. Well, actually, we've done some benchmarking internally. We have some benchmarks that are definitely not where we want them to be. We will eventually make those benchmarks public. You can see the code now, but we'll make the results of them public once we've finished tidying them up a little bit in our code base. All right, you have 5 minutes, and then we've got the Glimpse guys coming up to do a demo. So if anyone has any other questions, come down the front. If not, grab some lunch and head back in for Glimpse. Thank you.